Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the week started with the aftermath of a winter storm that brought ice and power outages, school closings, and fun.
So crazy.
Sledders taking advantage of the ice, but don't put those sleds away just yet. Actual snow may be coming. The combination of events in Minnesota and abroad and the fact that he is not running results in Tom Tillis letting loose on Christy Nome and Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller never fails to live up to my expectations of incompetence.
He says more, and we'll share it. Another measles case in Mecklenburg County. Katz talks about new ways to pay. The Black Political Caucus shares their endorsements. And a quarterback from Charlotte is headed to the Super Bowl. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE education reporter James Farrell. Ashley Fahey is managing editor of the the Charlotte Ledger. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
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 I want to point out that this is the 500th local news roundup on WFAE.
Wow. Congrats. Keep
count. Yes, thank you. Yes. It's not like the 14,000 episodes of Young and the Restless, but we're close. Okay.
Very close.
Let's begin with the story that broke late yesterday afternoon. Former District 3 Charlotte City Councilwoman Tijuana Brown has agreed to plead guilty to a count of conspiracy in a federal fraud case filed by the U.S. District Court for the Western District, or in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of North Carolina. Specifically, Ben, what has she agreed to plead guilty to?
The technical charge, I believe, is wire fraud conspiracy. And the guilty plea, I think, is notable because early on in this investigation, a year or so ago, she had said that this was all a big political attack on her as she was going to be up for reelection. And so to go from, hey, this is a political attack, to I am now pleading guilty to wire fraud. She says she wants to get it behind her. But it's quite a turnabout.
This is the second fraud charge. She served time in federal prison, I think about two decades ago, for a previous fraud charge. And as you pointed out, she ran for re-election on city council, lost. But all the time that she ran, she said that she was innocent of all this and that, in fact, she had paid back the money she was accused of taking. But that seems to me to be an admission of guilt right there. But late yesterday, she went on Facebook to share the news with her followers.
Breaking news today. I wasn't even in the courthouse. My attorneys worked up the deal for me. U.S. Attorney Office accepted it. We worked the deal. Okay? That's what you do.
That's what you do. Work the deal. Okay, digging down into the details of this case, this involves her two daughters as well. Are they taking the plea deal, or are they being charged separately in this case? Do we know?
Yeah, this all goes back to investigations related to COVID-19 relief funds. So right. I think there's 15 in all between April 2020 and I think 2021 of the next year in September. And prosecutors had alleged in this that she used that money for personal spending, for her birthday, which was extravagant, supposedly spent $15,000 on this party that had, I think, a horse-drawn carriage, a rented throne, and then also as a side of that, Louis Vuitton merchandise was purchased as well as part of this allegation.
So this is an agreement, a plea agreement. Does the judge, I guess she'll make this plea when she goes to court, and the case date for that has not been set yet, but when she does, could the judge reject it?
Technically, yes. There are people out there that are better qualified than I that can talk about exactly the options for a judge. But yeah, I mean, this is not technically a done deal. A judge still has to sign off on it.
Okay, moving on. The historic.
Actually, I really would like to just say briefly, for a lot of people, this is a disappointment. She is someone, the first person I think who had served time to serve on the council. And for a lot of people out there, her constituents looking for a second chance, and she had this nonprofit Beauty After the Bars, she was someone that they could look up to and who felt, you know, she understands what I'm going through as I'm trying to make my way back into society. And so it is a real disappointment for a lot of folks, because she did have a lot of support for people who felt that maybe their point of view wasn't being expressed.
Well, how are they going to feel? How are they going to feel about the fact that she said, "I'm innocent, I'm innocent, I'm innocent," while she was trying to get reelected, and now she's taking a plea deal, which does not necessarily indicate guilt. It just means you may not win in court, so this may be the better way to go, even if you're innocent. But what are they going to feel about that?
I'm not going to really predict and say how other people might feel. I just think that there will be a certain amount of disappointment about it, and a lot of people will be thinking about it.
Okay. The historic winter storm of last weekend was, in fact, historic, but thankfully we didn't suffer as much as we thought we might. And now actual snow may be on the way beginning tonight. Ben, you've been on the air all morning talking with your meteorologists at WCNC-TV. What's the bad news? What are they saying?
I feel like at this point, I could be like a de facto meteorologist at this point. I've talked about it for so much this morning. So here's the latest from our meteorologist in the morning, Chris Mulcahy. He says he's expecting between 4 and 7 inches, which, of course, if you lived in Charlotte any time at all, that would be very notable. You go back to a decade or more. Last time I think we saw 4 inches, and I think almost 20 years last time we saw something like 6 inches. Beyond the snow, And our meteorologists, they are very confident that we will see snow and plenty of it starting around midnight tonight, going through all day tomorrow. But aside from just the snow, I think the notable thing is the wind chill in the middle of the day tomorrow, the middle of the day, is supposed to be 8. So while the kids are going to want to get out and play in this, and yes, some of us adults will want to as well, we're going to last probably about 5 minutes because we live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and our blood gets cold and we're not going to be able to hang. So I just want to sort of, you know, scale back some of the expectations there. Yeah. So 8 wind chill tomorrow, I think, during the day. And then I think cold all day Sunday, don't get out of the freezing mark. And then Monday morning, I think the actual temperature is supposed to be 8 degrees, not the wind chill, the temperature. The snow is the big headline, of course, but I think over the next 48 hours, it's just also going to be bitterly cold.
And so a word to the wise, to adult men and boys who seem to be prone to this, do not wear shorts. It's going to be cold. Yes. Anyway, the National Weather Service keeps talking about this bomb cyclone coming to the East Coast and spreading this nasty weather from Atlanta to New England. Is the bomb cyclone portion of this really for the coastline, or are we part of this as well? Do you know?
Okay, now that goes above my level of expertise. Maybe I can't be a meteorologist after all. Yeah, once you start throwing things like that and Virga and bombogenesis, okay, that's above my pay grade.
Why don't we get Al Roker in here now?
Yeah, right. Okay.
So last weekend's storm led to school closings and virtual learning, and in fact, late openings. CMS opened 2 hours late again this morning. It's not open even as we speak, I don't think, James. So how long have area schools been hindered by last weekend's storm?
Yeah, it really feels like it's something that's been lasting all week. We had a cancellation at CMS Monday. I think pretty much every school was canceled Monday. We had 2 remote learning days, Tuesday and Wednesday, and then we had the 2-hour delay, and I think everyone was really surprised by the 2-hour day yesterday too. But the challenge here with a district like CMS in particular is that it's just so big that CMS has to take the whole county into account. So when you have schools or certain neighborhoods or certain parts of the county that are still iced over or not fully treated, you know, that becomes a district-wide decision because you have students that are in magnet programs that travel across the county. You have teachers and staff members who are coming from other parts of the county, and they're taking all that into account before they tell people to go on the roads and start traveling to school again.
So we've been hearing about this possible snow this weekend. It's likely to happen, although I heard yesterday it was going to start at like 6 o'clock tonight, and now it's midnight. So maybe that's a good sign that we're not as positive as we thought we were 3 days ago. But what plans have been made by CMS and other school systems for Monday?
Yeah, so far we've just been hearing kind of a lot of like wait and see. CMS is canceling its weekend events and saying that they're going to be monitoring the weather on Monday. So we don't have any decisions yet at this point, but something obviously they're going to be continuing to watch. It's hard to imagine them not doing something after seeing the whole week of what they did this week, but we'll have to see.
Yeah. So Charlotte has not, as Ben mentioned, has not experienced an inch of snow in a single day for more than 4 years. And if what forecasters say is right, we will break that streak over the weekend beginning tonight. Just remember that Groundhog Day is Monday. Depending upon whether Bill Murray sees his shadow, this could be over sooner or later. We'll have to wait and see. Ice has a different connotation now, particularly in Minnesota. The killing of two U.S. citizens in Minneapolis by federal officials trying to apprehend illegal aliens and the way in which ICE has been conducting itself is raising questions on both sides of the political aisle. Among the most outspoken have been Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski and North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis. He had a lot to get off his chest, and not just about Minnesota. He also took aim at Deputy White House Chief of Staff for Policy and Homeland Security Advisor Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller was the one who got out in front on Greenland. It's not working the way he said it was. He got out in front and told the president before he'd even taken the time to understand the incident that happened in Minneapolis that a terrorist had been killed and was brandishing a weapon. It's like this. These are amateurs in the strictest sense of the word.
And as he spoke to reporters, he added this.
Stephen Miller never fails to live up to my expectations of incompetence.
Why do you think he should resign?
I'm going to leave that up to the president. I can tell you, if I were president, neither one of them would be in Washington right now.
So are the gloves coming off, Mary, because the president has plummeting poll numbers, which threaten Republicans in the midterms, or because Tillis is not running, so he feels quite free to speak his mind?
Well, it is kind of interesting. Usually you couldn't get a comment out of him. Now, I mean, you can't shut him up. This guy has so much to say. And you have a feeling he's been holding these lines in. Well, the thing of it is first of all, I believe that Tillis not only criticized Kristi Noem on her Minnesota response, but also FEMA. And we know in North Carolina, they've been talking about FEMA funds. So he's pretty much saying she really is not doing any part of her job.
Let me play that comment for you, because he used the word amateur and expressed no confidence in Kristi Noem, largely because of what happened in Minneapolis, what she said about Alex Pretty, but also about other aspects of her reign as head of the Homeland Security Department.
She has taken this administration into the ground on an issue that we should own. We should own the issue of border security and immigration, but they have destroyed that for Republicans. Something that got the president elected, they have destroyed it through their incompetence.
And his opinion of her incompetence doesn't stop there, as Mary alluded to. It includes the way she's approached running FEMA.
To give you an idea of how incompetent I think she is, she actually thought FEMA should be eliminated. And when she had a FEMA director said he didn't think that was a good idea, she fired him within 24 hours. Now she understands that that is an important part of her job. These are like amateurish assistant manager sort of thought processes going into somebody who's a secretary in a cabinet level position. It's unacceptable.
Oh, but it gets worse. As a result of this, Donald Trump called Tillis a loser, and a reporter asked Tillis for his reaction.
President called you a loser, I believe.
I am thrilled about that. That makes me qualified to be Homeland Security Secretary and Senior Advisor to the President.
Da-da-da.
Rim shot. I'll be here all week, folks. How extraordinary is this?
Well, as I said, part of it too is, I think this Minnesota, immigration, that was something that got Donald Trump elected on that issue. And it's just seeing, when you see your neighbors, when you see what's going on in Minnesota, and when you see members of the administration come out before there's any investigation and malign someone, I mean, usually the leader of a country or the leaders of the country would first say, this is a tragedy, but they didn't even have that human decency. And we all saw the video.
This is getting reaction, as I said, from both sides of the political aisle. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the things being said by other members of the North Carolina congressional delegation about what's been happening in Minneapolis and with ICE. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. We're here with Ben Thompson from WCNC-TV, where he is an anchor. James Farrell is our education reporter at WFAE News. Ashley Faye is managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and host of their Equal Time podcast. Ben, you wanted to comment on something we were talking about prior to the break.
Yeah, I want to pour a little bit of water on this whole notion of Tom Tillis being a new renegade. I think perhaps, yes, he's newly emboldened, but also keep in mind Tom Tillis was censured by the state GOP a couple of years ago for being out of line with what they consider to be party norms. So I think he's been walking what is a very, very tightrope, trying to criticize the president's staff, Stephen Miller, and Kristi Noem, while not criticizing the president himself. You can argue whether or not he's been successful in doing that, but that's what he's been doing. Even the loser comment, Tillis responded to that later about saying that he and president enjoy a good back and forth, and he's perfectly fine with it. Mm-hmm. So it's part of what has been a tendency of Mr. Tillis to step outside the boundaries of his party on occasion and get them rather upset.
Yeah, he's been called a rhino, a Republican in name only, and Andrew Dunn, who is the conservative columnist in the Charlotte Observer, has a column about this morning about who the real Tom Tillis is, and perhaps this is who he's been all along. He just hasn't felt free to express himself, Mary.
Yeah, and also they had a vote because we have this fast-breaking news. They're trying not to have a partial government shutdown, and a lot of Democrats don't want to fund ICE. And actually, Tom Tillis voted for the funding bill. They're trying to make a deal. And the president himself, Trump is so savvy about putting his finger up to the wind and seeing what's going on. So even he pulled back from some of the language of Noem and Stephen Miller and said, well, you know, and he plays it back and forth. He also calls Alex Pretty an insurrectionist as well. But we see that looking at the polls and saying, well, maybe I should make some kind of a compromise and try to come off as the adult in the room, which, of course, you know, he's not. But
meanwhile, North Carolina's other Republican senator, who generally is quiet about a lot of things, Ted Budd, was critical of operations in Minnesota. He released a 340-word statement on social media saying that Alex Pretty, the man who they shot recently in Minneapolis, that his shooting was a, quote, tragedy that should never have happened, and he called for an investigation into the incident. Other members of the North Carolina congressional delegations have had things to say. Republican Chuck Edwards called for a fair investigation for federal officials in charge to appearing at a hearing. He wanted them to come to a hearing in Washington. Patrick Harrigan was quiet about this. Mark Harris criticized Democratic leadership in Minnesota. Will these Republicans and their voices be influential in changing policy, or is this just going to tamp it down for a week or so and then off we go to the races, Ben?
I think in the case specifically of Ted Budd, who owns a gun store, but also among other Republicans who are strong Second Amendment supporters, you have this intersection of two opposing forces right here. In this case, is that you have a man who legally had a gun, but you also have an administration and a Department of Homeland Security using that as a reason, as an excuse for what the Homeland Security officers did, which goes in complete opposition to what a lot of Republicans feel when it comes to Second Amendment rights. And so this is a more delicate issue for them. And I think for a lot of people like Chuck Edwards, like Tim Moore, calling for investigations, I think you might see more of that.
And you also see them, a lot of them, pivoting to blaming Democrats. They'll say this is a terrible thing, but they are the ones that weren't enforcing, immigration rules. And they're the ones that are amping the rhetoric. And so it's really difficult, though, when you have such incredible rhetoric coming from Republicans. The same as Ben said with the gun issue. If they're, you know, touting Kyle Rittenhouse and looking at January 6th, where a lot of people had weapons and were beating police, it's very difficult to say the act of having a gun means that you should be looked on as someone who's a threat.
When it comes to talking about rhetoric, Pot Kettle Black, comes to mind, given the fact that most of it's coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Nationwide activists are calling for an economic boycott today. No work, no school, no shopping, as a general strike to protest against ICE. This came out, I think, Wednesday of this week. That doesn't give you a lot of time to organize for a Friday walkout. Anybody on this panel aware of any efforts to do that here in Charlotte? Nope, I didn't think so. Well, the measles outbreak in Spartanburg is now the largest in the United States since the disease was declared eliminated more than 20 years ago. 789 cases reported as of Tuesday, eclipsing the 762 in Texas before that outbreak ended in August. And this week, another case was reported in Mecklenburg County. That's three cases since December. Why so many in South Carolina and so few here? Because the former head of the Mecklenburg County Health Department was worried, particularly around the holidays, that the Spartanburg cases would spread here because of travel for the holidays. Does it all boil down to vaccination rates?
Well, I think right now, I mean, the other number you put out there in Spartanburg County, there's 557 people currently in quarantine. That is because those are people who were exposed for one, but not only exposed, but aren't vaccinated. And so they're concerned. So you have this sort of looming number that could explode at any point there. And of course, those people come into contact with other people. Spartanburg County is not that far down the road. It's what, an hour and a half or something like that.
Yeah.
And when you compare that like to historical context of It was back in, I think, the year 2000 that this was declared eliminated. And here we are 25 years later, dealing with something that we thought as not just a country, but around the world that thought that we had sort of eliminated is a shock to a lot of folks.
Yeah, the latest, was Ashley, was that you?
I was just going to say, Mike, to add to that, you know, most of the cases in the Spartanburg, you know, instance, the breakout there have been among unvaccinated children and teens. And a lot of the officials down there are saying, you know, it is your choice ultimately if you don't get your children vaccinated. But the MMR vaccine has been one of the longest standing proven vaccines. It's not as new as the COVID vaccine, for example. So, but yeah, vaccine, I mean, I think it's no surprise that the vaccine skepticism is kind of at the center of this.
And it's called MMR because it protects you against measles, mumps, and rubella. Mary.
Yeah, and it's also political because you hear a lot of the officials in South Carolina saying, listen, if parents have the choice and you want the religious exemption, that's fine. And we're not saying you need to get this vaccine, even though this one is safe. But you know, we might have to kind of limit who plays sports and these kinds of things. So they're saying, if you make this choice and we start, you know, getting more and more cases of this, we'll have to look at other ways to try to cut down on this, group of people who are getting all these young children who are getting measles.
That parallels something a gubernatorial candidate in South Carolina talked about this week. Most of the cases in the Palmetto State were clustered among private religious school children who were subsequently quarantined. And South Carolina Republican gubernatorial candidate Josh Kimbrell, who represents Spartanburg County, told WFAE's Nick Delacanal that his state is approaching a tipping point where even people who were vaccinated in their youth could become infected again, and called that a very scary place to be. Yet, he advocates getting vaccinated, but he stresses, because it's politics, his support for other options, and they will have to be explored.
Nobody's saying that we're going to revoke religious liberty exemptions or that we're going to force people to be vaccinated who just vehemently don't want to be, but that does mean we may have to have some restrictions on participation in, for example, sports for a bit. We may have to have an e-learning option for a while.
This speaks to something that's happening in the wider zeitgeist, for lack of a better term, of this entire country. These vaccines, as you have pointed out, Ashley, have been used for decades. They have been proven to be safe. They protect you. More importantly, they protect others, young children who are too young to get the vaccine, people who are immunocompromised. What has happened, Mary, to our sense of community, our sense of shared responsibility? Because it's not just with regard to this, it's everywhere. It's across the board.
Well, first of all, there have been a real, people do not trust expertise anymore. So in a sense, you could say sometimes people listen too much to their doctors on things, but now they go into the doctor and the doctor will recommend something and they'll say, well, I saw this on the internet. You have RFK Jr., who was a vaccine skeptic, you know, who's basically ahead of the country's policy on this. He's appointed so many people to his boards and to these organizations and to the departments that don't believe, that are doubters in these things. And people who really should know better are saying this. And then they're upset when their kids are getting this. And measles is highly contagious. Right. And we know this, but there is this lack of trust and expertise. And then also, as you say, the sense of the public good, which you see in so many issues from immigration to health. I mean, in immigration, it's when the person next to me, who is my neighbor, is being caught. Well, then I'm concerned. When it comes to my household, I am concerned. And we've seen this over and over again.
Ben.
You know, it sort of reminds me of a conversation we talked about earlier, and that is skepticism of what our meteorologists do. And they see it, and they see it seriously on a daily basis. And I can tell you, just anecdotally, in our building here at WCNC, our meteorologists are literally the smartest men in the room and smartest women.
Let me just stop right there, because I've said this many times. The only person that you're watching on television or listening to on the radio who has a high degree is a meteorologist. The rest of us are jokers.
Yes. And they'll be the first to admit that it's a science that still evolves and still changes. But to me, it's the same sort of skepticism that's based often on social media. Listen, I'm all about being a contrarian, but being contrarian when you actually know better. And so this reminds me of the same thing.
Okay. I want to move on from this, but perhaps it is where the rubber meets the road is money, because America is all about money, and it's increasingly becoming about money and nothing else. How much I get, how much you don't have, how much it costs. And we are quarantining people in South Carolina. We have people in Mecklenburg County and Union County now. The health departments in both counties are coordinating their investigation, because the latest case is a Mecklenburg County child who is unvaccinated but who attends school in Union County. So they're going out to investigate, to notify, to test, to quarantine, and vaccinate people who may have been exposed. How much money is this costing taxpayers?
You're asking a question you know we don't have an answer to.
Exactly right.
Can we say a lot? And will that help?
That's right. I'm just throwing it out there. Okay. So Charlotte Transit, CATS, has unveiled plans for a major overhaul of how they collect fares. Ben, what are they proposing? Ben, unmute yourself, Ben.
Sorry. My apologies. So this all goes back to an 18-month study. So I sort of want to put that at the forefront, because this is not in direct response to some of the issues on light rail we've seen over the last few months. This has been ongoing. They say they're not going to increase fares necessarily, but they do want to find a way to make the way you pay for a fare more streamlined. They're talking about putting what they call these validators on the platform. And that's how you would pay before you go on to the train right now, which is where the way it's supposed to work is there will be somebody who comes by and checks. We know that doesn't happen on a regular basis. But I want to say this just real quickly, that this still doesn't address really the closed platform, open platform discussion that we've had post Irina Zarutska and the other stabbing on the light rail in December, which really addresses making sure the wrong people don't end up on transit who are not paying for it.
So this validation system, this electronic validation system, would be installed on train platforms. And a consultant, Mila Bushinskaya, explained how the system would work.
It can accept payments, and it can validate for a payment you already have to make sure that you have proof of payment before you enter the paid fare zone that was shown on the rendering and designated by Blue Line.
But we still don't have turnstiles. We don't have gates. You walk onto the platform, you can use this system or not. How does that help?
I'm not convinced it helps from a safety standpoint. Does it help streamline the process of paying for a fare? Oh, I'm sure it does that. But, yeah,
if no one's going to check that you did it, unless the door chimes when you walk through the door of the train and you haven't got a validated thing, how are they going to check? What's the difference?
I don't think this is going to answer that portion of it.
They're also talking about making you pay for something that heretofore has been free, and that is the streetcar. How much and when?
I don't actually know how much. I know now because I've heard
you. It's $2.20, I think, something like that.
That's the same as the Blue Line.
Yeah, and they want us to get like other cities have, like smart cards, metro cards, all of these things, and sort of, you know, break down all the different fare levels just to simplify, as Ben said, simplify and streamline. But there's still questions open
and they're
safety.
Going to be streamlining how many different fare rates there are. Evidently, there are 40 different categories of fare rates now. They're taking it down to something smaller, and it would also, they say, eliminate the need to purchase day, weekly, or monthly passes up front. Instead, this system would calculate your best price. Are we talking about just the trains here, or are we talking about the buses and the streetcars too?
I believe it's all of them. And what you're talking about is it would put a cap. So a local fare customer, whether it's from the train or the bus, would be capped at paying no more than $6.60 a day. It's $30.80 a week. And then I think just under $90 for the month. It would cap that.
Okay.
Other cities do that already. Yeah, other cities also do that.
Is this just a proposal? Or is this going to go before the public before they do it? Or they have a start date in mind?
They have several more meetings over the next 2 weeks to get public's feedback.
Okay. The Levine Museum of the New South, which has been a vagabond wanderer for quite a while, since they sold their old home on 7th Street, it has a new location. Ashley, what's the plan? Where is it?
Yeah, so they're under contract. I suspect they might be closing today, though, on the site at the corner of South Boulevard and right where East and West intersect. So right near where the light rail is, the East-West station. It's where the Grace Covenant Church site is, which is very historically significant, actually. It's been around since like the early 1900s. I heard that Billy Graham once attended services there. And in the renderings that the Levine Museum of the New South shared this week, that church is depicted in the rendering. So the museum hasn't said much about what they plan. Even the rendering that they've shown this week, which shows this very large, modern-looking facility kind of next to the church, you know, even that's conceptual in nature. The museum's going to be doing about a year of outreach to get feedback. They need to go through a number of processes with the city and the county and others to get kind of, you know, understand what they're doing here. But it's a big move for the Levine Museum.
And their new CEO, Richard Cooper, says this will be more than a museum. It will be a gathering space.
We'll just allow the community to come in and, you know, share reflections. We'll have test exhibitions that we'll put into the space. So it's a lot of building for what we'll build out over the next couple of years.
So I have 10 seconds. Do they have a timeline for this?
No, but expect the next couple of years.
Okay. We'll come back. We'll talk about a blood shortage that is resulting from our inclement weather and more, plus the Black Political Caucus endorsements.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter. A lot of school news to get to in the next segment. Ashley Fay, he's managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Mary C. Curtis, the columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Ben Thompson, an anchor at WCNC-TV. Ben, the American Red Cross is warning of a severe blood shortage. Why?
Yeah, it's down some 35% this year. You've got a sort of a confluence of factors here, Mike, that leading to this. You've got the winter weather we've talked about. You also have a really bad flu season as well. It's kept, they think, a lot of people from going that typically would go. Shortages specifically, they need type A, type O, type A negative, type B negative, and type O. So they're encouraging folks to get out when they can.
And you spoke to a blood donor, WCNC-TV did, Mary Stokes. She's been donating blood for 40 years.
I'm O negative, and that's the universal donor. And I think the thing that really drives me is babies can take my blood, so newborn untyped babies. So I saw the appeal the other day. They needed O negative, so I decided to come in.
So donations are down about 35% this month. And that means that the hospital is having very carefully managed limited blood supplies. Do we know what it will take to end this shortage?
It's going to take all of us getting out there. And they're trying to encourage people as much as they can. They're giving away $20 gift cards. And if that's not enough, they're offering a chance to take a trip to the Super Bowl. But that's at the point that they're at now, just trying to find ways to get people there against the flu they've been facing and the winter weather that's coming our way in about 12 hours.
He said. The Charlotte Ledger is reporting this week, Ashley, that a rising number of emergency room visits related to marijuana and other types of cannabis ingestion by young adults. Healthcare professionals say it is alarming. What are the numbers?
Yeah, so last year, according to an Atrium Health doctor who tracks this, they found more than 765 instances of cannabis-related issues based on diagnostic codes. Now, some of this is new. The main concern they're seeing is related to, and I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation of this, but cannabidinoid hyperemesis syndrome. I'm just going to call it CHS from now on.
Good.
Basically, it's this condition that includes nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and something that social media has dubbed scromiting, which is a horrifying combination of screaming and vomiting. So ERs across North Carolina, including Charlotte, are seeing an uptick in this. And this comes at a time when the state is trying to figure out how to regulate cannabis. You know, we know marijuana is illegal in North Carolina, but there are some loopholes that we have seen distribution of highly intoxicating THC products across the state. And ER doctors are just seeing a lot more instances of especially young people coming into emergency rooms with these symptoms.
So to be clear, this is from eating or swallowing these cannabis products, correct?
From what I understand, mostly, yes. But ingestion in general, it's sometimes hard to know exactly what the origin is because a lot of times there's so much stigma around cannabis use. When folks come into the ER, they may not be super forthright about, you know, what they did or didn't do. So some of that's a little murky. But yeah, Mike, to your point, that's probably a lot of it.
So I've never heard of this before. Is this something rare, something new? What is it?
It's new-ish. It's really been, I mean, cases of this have gone back to 2016, but I think it's in the mainstream a lot more now. And the doctors that spoke with the Ledger basically indicated these folks are looking for these higher potency products, which are causing more of these symptoms rather than just the traditional smoking a joint, so to speak. So it's really the potency in these products, I think, that's causing it.
And the Ledger reports that treatment for this includes anti-nausea medications, hot baths and showers, and pain-relieving creams. The only cure, however, is to stop cannabis use. Oh, no, man.
I hope nobody was eating breakfast just then. I swear. Oh, goodness.
James, you recently joined the Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board on their Winston-Salem retreat where they discussed plans for a major magnet school overhaul, among other things. Why do they feel an overhaul is necessary?
Right. So, first of all, this is part of their comprehensive review, which is this big deep dive into how the school's programs are working that they're supposed to do every 4 years, but it hasn't been done since 2017. So some changes are definitely overdue. In this case, they're trying to look at the fact that, for instance, you might have some magnet programs that have really high wait lists and a lot of people want to go to them, but then the same program in another part of the county maybe doesn't have that. They're trying to make it so that the program offerings at each school can be seen as being implemented with fidelity across the district. So if you go to a STEM program in one part of the county or STEM program in another part of the county, you know you're getting that same STEM experience. They're also trying to shift the philosophy behind what they currently call like a school choice process and make it more of a program choice process. What they found is there's a lot of parents who go into the magnet program because they don't like their home school or they don't want to go to their home school that they're assigned to from an attendance boundary, and instead they go through the magnet process to try to find another school to go to. The goal is they want to make it where the goal of the magnet lottery process is to try to get into one of these really exciting top-tier programs. And not so much to get just to a different school, which they're encouraging parents to go through the normal transfer process if you don't want to go to your home school.
And they're talking about, they're considering reducing the number of magnet themes from 16 down to 6. That seems like a big reduction. They say the goal is to cut down on duplicative programs and to consolidate resources. How dramatic or traumatic might that end up being for students in these programs?
That's a great question. I think we'll see some of that come out throughout the comprehensive review. They're going to have a whole bunch of public engagement. So we'll start to hear who's actually being affected as these actual proposals come forward. And you could see which school communities might be upset to hear that their magnet program is leaving that school. But it is going to be a pretty significant change. 16 down to 6 is quite a bit. They are planning on trying to add more CTE offerings at every high school to try to kind of make it so that there's more opportunities spread out that are kind of like magnet programs, but they're CTE offerings that would just be at every high school. It's definitely a big change. It's a big philosophy change trying to get people to go into these programs because they want a Montessori program or a STEM program or an early college program, and not just because they're looking for a different school than what they're zoned to in their attendance boundary.
They also considered a proposal, Ashley, to reopen E.E. Waddell as a full high school. What is it now? Why would they want to reopen it? And what would that mean for kids attending other high schools who would have to fill the seats in the classrooms there?
Yeah, so E.E. Waddell has been used as a magnet school for the last 15 years. It's also home to the district's PACE program, which is students who are learning English. So this proposal, which again, still in the early phases here of discussion, would require probably redrawing school attendance boundaries, which is always a contentious issue, I think, anywhere in CMS, but maybe arguably, especially in South Charlotte, which this would impact. The school is on Nations Ford Road. It's in the Olympic attendance zone right now. But if this proposal moves forward, it could impact the zones of schools like Myers Park, South Mecklenburg, Ballantyne Ridge. So I think this is something that, you know, we'll be keeping a close eye on to see what happens. But it could change, you know, not only just the actual high school zones, it could also change feeder patterns of nearby elementary and middle schools. So again, early stages, but redrawing, I think, boundary lines are always contentious.
James.
Yeah, just to kind of piggyback off that point, that's all part of this same comprehensive review. And every time this comprehensive review comes around, it is contentious. There's a lot of parents who get affected by it, who want to know more, who have concerns about the way the attendance boundaries are redrawn. So it's going to be an interesting year as they try to embark on this overdue comprehensive review. And we see all these changes potentially happening at once. Again, like Ashley said, preliminary still. So we'll have to see what actually comes forward. But there's a chance for there to be some real fireworks, some tough discussions as we look at this review continuing to go on this year.
When will they decide?
That's a great question. Okay. There's no formal proposal yet, right? The retreat is a pretty informal gathering where they're kind of just sharing long-term planning and vision and things like that. So it's going to take some time for this to come up as a formal proposal, and then there'll be public engagement, and then there'll be a formal recommendation from the superintendent that'll have to be voted on. So there's a lot of steps to go for before we get there. We know that the all of these changes are being eyed to be implemented by the 27-28 school year. So not this upcoming school year, but the one after.
Speaking of that school year, CMS is also working on a new academic calendar for 27-28 that would consolidate and replace early release days with full teacher work days. Explain that.
Yeah, so this was something that CMS decided to do after having a working group that consisted of parents and staff. They felt that there was a consensus that these early release days ended up causing more kind of confusion. It was harder for some parents to navigate things like childcare. Staff members were reporting that there were higher absentee rates on those days anyway, and that they preferred from a professional development standpoint to have the full teacher work days. So that's why they're going this route. Both of the calendar options that you can look at as part of the survey process have that in it, where these four early release days for professional development have been condensed to two full teacher work days.
And the chief strategy and innovation officer, Beth Thompson at CMS, says this idea comes from a working group of parents and teachers.
Working group parent members cited that early release days are very difficult for childcare. Staff members who were on the working group indicated that there is increased student absenteeism on early release days.
These calendars may end up being three calendars. They may have to choose between among three calendars. They would change the start and end dates for school by how much? Not much.
Yeah, not much, because state law requires them to be at the latter half of August anyway. I forget the exact ruling there, but near the end of August. So they don't have that much flexibility on the start day. Obviously, that's a contentious point. A lot of school districts ignore that law because they prefer to start earlier in August. CMS is not one of those school districts, so you wouldn't see great variation there. But, you know, Mike, like you said, there's two options on the calendar. They said that depending on the kind of feedback they get from this survey, they might create a third option if there's something that really floats to the surface. But otherwise, there's these two to choose from, and Superintendent Hill will have to pick one as a formal recommendation.
And finally, Ashley, CMS's top lawyer, their general counsel, Andre Mays, is apparently leaving. She has, I think, the rest of the year on her contract, but they're paying her for the year not to go. Is this another instance of paying employees not to work, which seems to be rampant throughout the Mecklenburg County, Charlotte city government system right now?
Well, Mike, I'll say this. The circumstances around Andre Mays' departure have been a little sketchy, I'll say. So the Ledger kind of got wind of this fact earlier this month. We requested some records from CMS, and we got some back that said she's still employed. And then at the retreat last weekend, Ledger executive editor Tony Macia went and confirmed that Andre Mays, her last day would be February 2nd. We obtained the separation agreement this week, which indicates that she would get $289,000 for a year. That would be a salary she would get for a year after she leaves at the end of the month, meaning right now here at the end of January. And notably, in the employment contract, she is entitled to 1 year of salary if she is fired from the job. There's nothing in the employment agreement that says that she would get paid if she left voluntarily. So I think this is a matter of the circumstances around why she's leaving, which I don't have the answer to, rather than anything else. It's been a very strange situation, though, and it's transpired over the last few weeks.
And there was a story at WBTV that indicated that they were inferring that perhaps this was partly due to their requests for information from the system about sexual assault cases that they drug their feet on releasing, and perhaps that's why it led to this. We don't know for a fact. Mecklenburg's Black Political Caucus has decided not to endorse incumbent State House member Carla Cunningham. They chose her Democratic primary challenger, Reverend Rodney Sadler, instead. They also backed Monifa Drayton over veteran Vilma Leek in Charlotte District 2 County Commission race. But they did endorse embattled Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden and District 99 State House Representative Nasif Majid, who has been found on multiple occasions to side with Republicans in the legislature over his Democratic counterparts. They also endorsed former Governor Roy Cooper. How important are these endorsements, Mary?
Well, I think they're a pretty influential group. And I know a lot of folks very pay attention to the sheet they put out of people who they have endorsed. And when we were talking, you know, before, they are pretty important. So I think people were very interested, particularly in backing the sheriff, because he does have, I think, three primary opponents. And of course, whichever Democrat wins will be the sheriff. And of course, Carla Cunningham, there's been so much publicity over her statements about immigrants, and also but she's been very vocal about, you know, voting with Republicans to overturn the vetoes of the governor. So she's been very much out there, and we see even the governor has come in to talk to endorse the opponent. So it'll be interesting. But yes, it's you know, people, they come out the sheet and people look at it, and they meet, and they're usually, you know, pretty effective.
Michael Kahn. Most people don't know who Michael Kahn is, but he's the former majority owner of the Charlotte Checkers. He's been accused of taking more than $4.5 million from a charity he founded, pocketing it, did not report it as personal income, and did not pay taxes on it. Ben, who levied the charges?
Yeah, this is coming from prosecutors, the local U.S. district attorney, and alleging this happened between 2020 and 2023. And I believe that Mr. Kahn sold the Checkers, had them for about 20 years, sold them about 2 years ago. As of right now, it looks like he could face 3 years plus in prison if convicted.
Well, not only that, prosecutors say the foundation that he ran, the Michael A. Kahn Family Foundation, was tax-exempt charity, which he ran by himself, holding every leadership position and employing no other officers, board members, or staff. Is that legal? Don't you have to have a board?
Typically, from my knowledge, yes. And Russ Ferguson spoke to our cameras yesterday outside the courthouse, saying that it's unfortunate when you have somebody with this much power and this much wealth to do something like this.
Finally, the Panthers may have lost out on their shot at the Super Bowl in the first playoff game, but that does not mean that Charlotte will not be represented. Charlotte native and New England Patriots quarterback Drake May will be there.
We're going to the Super Bowl. That sounds pretty good. That sounds pretty cool. So just proud of this team, proud of the defense. We didn't play our best ball in the first half, and the second half came out and just battling the elements, you know, snow and the elements, and it was a gritty win, and our defense, you know, they stepped up. It was fun to watch.
Drake May, courtesy of the New England Patriots, talking about the final game before the big one. He's just 23. He's the second youngest quarterback to play in the Super Bowl. So since the Panthers aren't in this one, Mary, who should we root for next week? The Patriots or the Seahawks or Bad Bunny?
Take your pick, but I mean, my son went to Myers Park High School. Drake May is a Myers Park Mustang. I mean, you gotta love him.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Mary Curtis. She's a columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. Ben Thompson joined us, an anchor from WCNC-TV, who brought the news of snow. Darn it. Ashley Fay, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger, and James Farrell, our education reporter here at WFAE News on the 500th WFAE Local News Roundup. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.